Corpse for everything paranormal. Para-X.
May the circle be open, but unbroken. May the peace of the goddess be ever in your heart. Merry meet and merry part, and merry meet again.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. We're going to slither into tonight's show because my guest is author Scotty Roberts, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Secret History of the Reptilians. Now, Scotty's a founder and publisher of Intrepid Magazine, which is a journal dedicated to politics, science and unexplained phenomenon. He's a radio show host and a public speaker and was editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters official publication, Taps Para Magazine. He attended Bible College and Theological Seminary, working towards his master's in divinity, but he left for a 33-year career in advertising. And a few weeks ago on Stirring the Cauldron, the Archives podcast, I ran a show that dated back several years, and many of those who listened in wanted to hear more of him. So I poked around and saw his book on reptilians and asked him to come back live. And for those of you in chat, get your questions and comments ready, because this book is very thought-provoking, as you'll see. And if I had asked Scotty all the questions that went through my head while I was reading it, we'd be talking nonstop for several hours instead of just 60 minutes. So, Scotty, we're going to get right into it. So welcome, and it's been a very long time.
Why, yes, it has, Marla. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I think we both have gray hair now, don't we?
mine's more to the whitish side of gray. I was just lamenting that today. I had my hair cut today. And the young lady cutting my hair, I said, you know, it's gone very thin and very white. I said, is there anything you can do about that? And she said, sorry, I can just make it look as good as we can.
Just shine it up. That's all you can do.
There it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see if reptilians are going to give anybody gray hair tonight. Because when I think when people think of reptilians, I mean, from a religious aspect, it's the Garden of Eden that comes to mind. From pop culture, we think about the reptilian species of aliens that have infiltrated our world and have shapeshifted into the human forms of the British royal family and the entire George Bush clan. But but I'm sure that reptilians have been acknowledged way back before the Garden of Eden. So I'm really kind of curious as to how far back they do go in ancient history.
Well, they go back, obviously, as far as recorded history. They're mentioned in one form or another. Of course, you've got, this isn't the beginning of recorded history, but when you've got the biblical texts, the Old Testament texts, they make reference to the reptilians, not in the same way we might think, but they correlate to almost every other ancient culture that exists. You can go back into the Sumerian culture and find references to the reptilian. Now, some people out there, you may have seen, and I mentioned this in the book, and I show some pictures of some of the little clay figurines and the sculptures that date back into the Sumerian period. This Sumer-Akkad period in the Euphrates River Valley. And you can look at those figurines and go, aha, maybe this means there was some kind of worship of reptilians, or there was some kind of reptilian overlord or so on. The problem we have with that is not that those statuettes don't exist and that theories don't abound. The problem is this: when we look at any ancient culture, and we start looking at things from an anthropological point of view or an historical point of view or an archaeological point of view, we can't put our meanings onto things to make it mean what we think it ought to mean. We have to go by the evidence that exists. And so many times, this is what we do with some of these theories. I happen to be a person where I would call myself a skeptical believer. I am somebody who, like Fox Mulder always, I want to believe. There are certain things that I find mysterious and I find exciting. There are certain experiences I have, which we would classify scientifically as anecdotal experiences. And all of these things build up to a belief system I may have structured, yet cannot really support with physical evidence. It kind of, we can say, it kind of looks like that. Oh, maybe the Chinese were onto something 8,000 years ago. Maybe the Sumerians were in 4,500 BCE. Maybe the Israelites were, maybe the Africans were, that there's evidences of things that look like that. But the problem is this. It's like when I put in, I was looking at the more mythos side of this, current day mythos, the alien reptilians that came to this planet and you know, subjugated the human race. And, you know, we know how the theory goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I started typing in, when I was writing the book, I was actually paused on a paragraph because I typed in, I said, I'm going to Google this topic. And this was about 7-8 years ago when I wrote the book. And I Googled the topic and I put in reptilian aliens. And at the time, I came up with something like 8.2, or it was, I might be inverting that, 2.8 million hits online through Google for reptilian aliens. And the first 10 that appeared in my list all gave the same exact story, word for word, verbatim. They were all copied from one other source or from each other. The problem was all of these sites were not related to each other. None of them were. And none of them gave source materials. And so this is what I mean by having a theory and going out there and saying, is there evidence to back up that theory? If you even look for evidence in a cursory, superficial internet search, you're going to find the topic 8.2 million times with nobody or very few people, if you dig hard enough, giving you any kind of source material. So what do you have as a source for this, other than history itself or archaeology or anthropology, and start digging into the stories that existed? And so, in a sense, that's a little bit of what I had to do. And, you know, you can't take it very deep because there's not a lot of information about it. When Zechariah Sitchin wrote about the reptilians, the reptilian factor, the alien factor, and he talked about the gods came down, the Anunnaki, the Anu, came down from the sky in fiery rockets. This was a theory he put forward, but there's nothing to back that up linguistically, and this is all on the same point of being able to prove your point. Linguistically, he took the word Sumerian, Mesopotamian, a word that said, that was mu, M-U, if you spell it in English. And that meant the curved firmament, the sky above us, curved firmament. And he read that, he used that word mu and interpreted it as the curved nose cone of a fiery rocket that came down to Earth. And so I said, there's no way you can draw that linguistically, anthropologically, historically, out of the word mu. And so this is something that you start to look at some of these evidences like this, and you say, intriguing theory you're onto, Zechariah. You might be onto something. The problem is it's an unprovable theory with the evidence you're using. As a matter of fact, there exists an ancient lexicon that dates back 3,500 to 4,000 years, which has the mu, the word mu on it in several different languages from around the region. And none of them define that word the same way. And now Zechariah Sitchin either missed that lexicon and didn't see it, the ancient lexicon, or he chose to use his own interpretation. So what happens to your story or your event or your thing you're writing about or theorizing on when you're squeezing a very big round peg into a very small square hole? So these are the types of things I look for when I try to draw conclusions.
Yeah, well, I was looking sometimes, around, too. Yeah, go ahead. Sometimes.
I was just going to say, sometimes it just goes against what I want it to be. I'm like, damn it. I can't find anything to back that up. This would be like I'll use one example, like biblical scholars who want to try to squeeze real history into biblical events. Well, mm-hmm. You can't do that. You have to make sure the biblical event aligns with what we know about history. And so we either have to leave the thing inconclusive, or you're wrong, or you're right because you can back it up with the data.
See, I was looking up stuff too, and I, you know, as far as historical references and things. I mean, so, you know, we all know that in hieroglyphics, there are snakes. The Egyptian myth has several snake gods, you know. And then there's Manasseh, you know, the goddess of snakes in the Hindu religion.
And, right.
Serpents in many cultures are worshipped. I mean, Moses made the serpent out of bronze, put it on a pole, and then people who were bitten by serpents were to touch the pole and get healed. But on the flip side, then you've got the evil and sinister side of serpents, like the bad guy in the Garden of Eden, or St. Patrick driving them out of Ireland, or terrible sea serpents that sunk ships, and the list goes on, you know. So, I mean,
you know what's interesting about that, if I can, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
you. No, sure. No.
I was jumping in on a breath, not a pause.
Good.
Moses lifting up the serpent in the wilderness. He creates a bronze serpent. What did he call that? In the Hebrew, it's the Nekoshte. And that was the name of the bronze, the brazen serpent. You're talking about the good and the evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in the book of Genesis, the serpent character, who we always were told in Sunday school or synagogue, this was Satan. Well, more Sunday school, the Jews did not have a Satan in that respect connected to this character. Yeah. But his name in the Hebrew, when you see serpent, is Nakosh. It's the base word for Moses' serpent on the pole, Nakoshte. It's the same word, only in a different form. And so you've got a good and an evil that is represented with the same character, with derivations from the same word. Neither of them denoting morality or goodness or badness or evil or good or anything like that. Nakosh was the name. Nakosh meant bringer of illumination, the illuminated one, the bright shining one. And when Moses created the serpent on the pole, it was the bright shining serpent on the pole. And it was the Nakoshte. And so, and I always, by the way, as an aside, I always thought about that passage where the Israelites are complaining and pissing and moaning to Moses. Oh, you brought us out here to die in the desert. Oh, and it says, and God sent snakes to bite them. I'm going to wipe out these people. You know, God was always so pissed off at everybody. I'm not just going to tell them, hey, you're wrong, get your act straight. I'm going to send snakes to bite them all and kill them. And the only way, and then Moses went and prayed for them, and God said, well, okay. Make a bronze serpent. Anybody who looks to the serpent will be healed. And so Moses does this. Yeah.
And I've got to interrupt because that just reminded me of something. We're going to be doing this back and forth all night. So, you know.
Sure.
Audience, please forgive us. But, I'm really bad at religion, all right? And the Ten Commandments should be on this weekend, so I'm going to watch it again. But what was the thing that when Moses grabbed everybody and took them into the desert and they were partying and having a great time and making false idols, and Moses said, you know, don't ever worship a false idol. Not in those words.
Right.
So then he makes the serpent thing on sticks it on a pole.
Yeah.
A little contradictory?
That's a little contradictory. It's a little bit of a violation of what he had said. Well, you know, the justification for that, you know what that is? A faith issue. Well, God said to do that, therefore it's okay.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like, you know, early mankind. There's only Adam, Eve, and Seth after... after Cain, you know, chicken scratches out his brother Abel, and these are supposedly the only four people on the earth now. Well, who did they have sex with to procreate and spread throughout the earth? Well, it was incestual. It was within the family. Well, isn't that a sin? We would ask in Sunday school, more advanced Sunday school in age. And well, God obviously made room for that to work, and there was a special manifestation for people to be able to do that, not manifestation, decree, whatever it is, to allow people to do that in the early stages. That was an okay thing. Well, why is it wrong now then? I would ask. Where did the consistency level change between God's command? Well, it's all dispensations and covenants and so on and so forth, all through the Bible. Okay, all right, I'll accept that. It's maybe not as bad as it's maybe the same exact thing they did early on, according to the scripture, which there's just a prohibition against it now. Because, you know, you'll have three-legged children or something. And so those types of things, and another one comes to mind, just stands out in my mind, and I got to tell you this one. Remember, Moses had all these people out in the wilderness, in the Sinai wilderness. They're living like a tribe of nomads. And it says, and Moses pitched his tent outside the camp, away from the camp, all alone. Mm-hmm. And he was a man alone. He was a man who maybe because he deemed himself as what he learned in his younger days as Egyptian royalty. And he pitched his tent outside the camp, and he wrote in the book of Exodus, and God would come to my tent and speak to me face to face as a man talks to his friend. And then 9 verses later said, no man shall see God's face and live. And you think, wow, this is only 9 verses apart in the biblical text. Mm-hmm. What was that contradiction all about? Well, that contradiction, you can say, well, Moses obviously was a man of Israelite blood who was raised as an Egyptian, raised into royalty as an Egyptian for the first 40 years of his life. And so what does he believe? He probably believes he is a brother to the gods, as he would have been taught in Egypt. Did he give that up when he had his burning bush experience with God, which, by the way, only he saw, only he experienced, and he wrote about it. So that's the way it happened, because I said so. But now he's saying God comes and talks to him face to face, but no man can see God's face and live. Why is that? I think he saw himself as more than a common man. He was brother to the gods. And not to delve into a different book I've written on Moses, but I think it's important for this. I believe that the actual historical man in Egyptian history who was Moses was a man in Egypt named Senenmut. And Senenmut was the grand vizier beneath the female pharaoh, Hatshepsut, in the 1400s BCE. And without getting into that whole story, because that's a whole nother conversation, but this is the guy that I've identified as being Moses. Now, even the name Senenmut meant, in Egyptian, mother's brother. And Hatshepsut, the queen, gave him that name, meaning, I, your mother, am elevating you to status of brother to the gods with me. And she gave him 92 other royal titles, although she was not his blood mother. And Egyptian history makes that very clear. Senenmut was a man born to commoners. You could say slaves, you could say servants, you could say whatever. Mm-hmm. And so now this name, you bring that back to the Moses we're talking about, who says, God's my friend, talks to me face to face. Why? Well, I'm Senenmut. I am the mother's brother. I am equal to the gods as an Egyptian royal family member. And so now bring that back into the whole reptilian thing that we're talking about. When Moses wrote about these things, he didn't write about reptilians. He didn't write about any of this. But you have to look into history, the point that I'm making with this. You have to look into history to understand how a text works, how linguistics work, how the situation works. Now, I happen to believe Moses was a real guy. I don't think there's any reason to doubt that. There's a lot of faith story built up around it. Same with the Garden of Eden. Was that a literal story or was that an encoded story? I think it's an encoded story about sexuality and breeding and all of that. And that comes out in the passage if you look at it closely enough. And this all fits into the reptile. Who was the reptile in the Garden of Eden story that Moses penned? It was Nakosh. It was the guy that the same character that he elevated in brazen form on a pole for people to be healed. And I would say the big question came to my mind, by the way, about that one is, why would God bring serpents to kill people, all those poor people who were only just tools of the Almighty's to, and by the way, anybody listening, I'm not trying to offend religious sensibility. I'm just talking about this the way I would talk about it to anybody else. Why would the God, who is the God of everyone, you are his chosen people, but because you're sinning and expressing your free will, all of a sudden he's going to kill you with a snake. Why? Because you griped and complained and moaned. God's patience was as long as the serpent's tail. And so he sends him to kill them all. Well, then Moses pleads on their behalf. And what happens? God says, okay, make the bronze serpent. If everybody touches it, they'll be healed. So Moses does this. So the same God who, according to the tale, the same God who brought the snakes to kill them also provides the way for them to have salvation from the things he brought upon them. And so many times you see that with this God. And I know maybe this whole thing's a rabbit trail, but this is all coming off of that idea that Moses took that serpentine figure, which did not become Satan, the devil, or Lucifer until almost 1,000 years after that passage was penned originally. That would have been written around 1400 BCE, or just before that. And it wasn't until about the 400s BCE that we started giving the serpent in the garden the connotation of Satan, Lucifer, the devil, because those concepts started to breed in theology, in Jewish theology. And so they didn't exist at the time of Moses when he would have penned that. So who are these reptilians is the big question. Who is this reptilian in the garden? Why is he a reptile? Why is he looked at as a reptile? I think it's an encoded message. I think it's a symbolic character.
Yeah, could have been a mouse. You never know.
Could have been a mouse.
I don't think it would be
imagine that.
Formidable, though. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't imagine, be good. Come and follow me to darkness. So, you know, anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, first off, if I read it correctly, the first alien reptilians came down and were benevolent. Correct me if I'm wrong. But then came the bad guys, the draconian reptilians, who created the gray aliens as slaves and forced the peaceful reptoids to leave the Earth. But some Earth-evolved reptoids are still here, and the good ones and the bad ones are fighting each other, and it gets a bit confusing. So you mentioned that, with little doubt, you believe that this planet has been visited by non-human intelligences of some sort.
Right.
Are you personally on the fence about them being reptilian in nature?
I don't know for certain. One of the things for me, I'm a fairly pragmatic fellow. I've got to see it, touch it, taste it, feel it, handle it, shake hands with it, have a drink with it, and throw back a pint with it in order to believe that it exists like you or I exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fairly pragmatic or even skeptical in that sense. However, when I look at this and I look at these stories that have been put together, cobbled together in some cases, you start to wonder if these things really ever happened. Or if they're symbolic, are there draconian reptilians that came down from outer space and maybe this is the one word plays on the other, but obviously from the constellation of Draco is where their planet resides. And they came down here, they found resources, they mined resources, they enslaved subprimordial humans, they bred them up in order to have working slaves. And as the, if you start looking at the, some of the Mesopotamian cuneiform texts, they read like Bible stories, they read like Bible stories on crack, some of them. You start looking at these stories, and you've got these beings, it sounds like, who have said, now this isn't biblical text, Judeo-Christian, this is Mesopotamian text. Mesopotamian text in the cuneiform says that they came down and they bred primordial man, a direct equivalent to the word primordial in ancient cuneiform. They bred primordial man to do their work for them, to mine their minerals and resources, to dig their canals, and to tend their crops, and that this is why they created them. Elil, or Enlil was his other name. The Mesopotamian, the god who was the chief god of the Anunnaki, said, let us do this with humankind, or with man, and breed him up. And who was it? It was Enki. Enki, also known as Ea, who mated with, her name slips my mind, the other goddess. And they created primordial man to do all this work for them. And so this is the basic story you find with the reptilian mythos, is that they came here to this planet. They took on forms of leaders here because they were mining our resources. And they needed someone to mine their resources, dig their canals, mine their crops, and so on. And now if you take this story, by the way, and extrapolate it over to the Garden of Eden story in the book of Genesis, what do you got? You got God created man, made a mate for him, put them in the garden to do what? To till the ground and keep it for him. Now they took out the mining part, they took out the digging trenches and canals part, but this is what man was even meant to do in the biblical story, to till the garden and keep it for God. And so now that's a more watered-down version of the Anunnaki story in Mesopotamia, which relates very closely, and this is why the Anunnaki are always brought in as comparatives to the reptilians that came down, because they came down, they subjugated humans, they bred humans up to do their work for them. But then there were earthbound reptilians that went to battle with them and warred with them over the domination of the earth. And that supposedly went on until today. It's even going on now behind the scenes, behind the presidents, behind the emperors, behind all the world leaders. The Royal House of Gwynedd in Wales, the Royal House of Great Britain, and so on. You know, Queen Elizabeth, she sheds her human skin every night to take a bath or something. Mm-hmm. And so this is the theory that's put forward, and this is how it has progressed in a very simplistic form over the ages here into the story we have now. And another interesting thing is that if you look in the ancient cuneiform tablets, you find the tale from Sumeria, you find the tale of Atrahasis. Atrahasis, the king of the city of Eridu. And Eridu, that city still exists today. It's in the backwater washes of the Euphrates River Valley. And he was the king of this city, and their patron god, according to the cuneiform texts, was Enki, or Enki Ea, was his Akkadian name. And he pleads to their patron god, Atrahasis does, for release from bondage to the Anunnaki, these creatures, these gods, who keep us subjugated to do all this work for them. And Enki, it says, and it sounds almost biblical, Enki responds to Atrahasis, "I have heard the words of my servant, and I will bend my ear to your needs and to your cries and your implications." And he says, "I will come and deliver you from the bondage to the Anu, to the gods." And so he comes down, or comes up, rather. He dwelt in the great Abzu, the underground sea, and he would come out into the backwaters of the Euphrates River around the city of Eridu, and it was called Enki's or Ea's Marsh, and it was also known as the Serpent's Marsh. So the two were linked together, the serpent and Enki, Ea. You even see in the old carvings of him, he's holding a serpent in one hand and water in the other hand. And so Enki, who's also known as Ea, comes down, fights the battle against the Anunnaki gods for Atrahasis and the humans. And for this, he wins their freedom, but Enlil, he condemns Enki and all his followers to the subterranean caverns of the earth to dwell forever. And now this Serpent's Marsh, known as the Serpent's Den, also Enki Ea, Ea's Den. Ea's Den, you start going forward about 1,000 to 1,500 years in history, and you see all these names repeated in biblical stories. Ea's Den becomes Ea-Den, or Eden, the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. You have Enlil, Ellil becomes El, El Shaddai, El Elyon, all the names for Elohim, all these names for God in the Bible. And then you've got Enki, Iyah. Iyah becomes the base word for the Canaanite word Yahweh, which is Yahweh is Jehovah.
Right.
And so you've got these two gods now are set up. You've got Elohim, you've got Jehovah, which mm-hmm. is the Latinized version of that, of Yahweh. And so you've got all these tales that come up. And you see, I'm not saying much about reptilians. This is all this culture is supposed to be what we are told is the reptilian culture. The Anunnaki were the reptilians. The Anunnaki worshipped the reptilians, had the people worship them. And this is where you might see some of the little castings and the sculptures and the clay figurines that represent the reptilian. This mm-hmm. is a representation of the Anunnaki at the time. And so it's very interesting when we start looking at all these things and cobbling together all the bits and pieces of this ancient religion that appear again in the New Testament. What happens in the New Testament? Remember, Enki comes down. He delivers the forbidden knowledge of the gods, helps the humans escape the bondage to the Anu, and is cast into the subterranean caverns of the earth to dwell forever. What happens in Genesis? The first family, they're working for God, tilling the ground, keeping it for him. The serpent appears, Nakosh, the bright and shining one, the bringer of forbidden information, the illuminated one. And what does he do? He sheds illumination on Adam and Eve. And for this, they are all cursed, and the serpent is cursed, and on his belly he shall go, God says. And then he utters the first Jewish messianic prophecy, a prophecy of a coming Messiah, a kinsman redeemer, as he was known. And that is when he said to the serpent, to them all, he said, there will be a day when the serpent will bite his heel. We don't know who the antecedent of his is there, linguistically. But the serpent shall bite his heel, and he shall return and crush the serpent's head. It's believed in rabbinic tradition, a Christian tradition, or a Hebrew tradition, that this is the first prophecy of a coming Messiah that was supposed to be what they knew as the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be a redeemer who was one of us to save us from. You start going through all the Old Testament, you will find out from the earliest days in the Old Testament, the genealogies and everything was laying out the family genealogical line of the pure humans. Not a racist statement when I say pure, but the humans who had no taint of the blood of the Nephilim, the blood of the reptilian. There you go.
Okay, keep that thought, because we got to take a quick break, and we've got questions from the chat room. So everybody get up, stretch, 2 seconds. We'll be right back.
Don't go away. There's more Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks right after these important messages. From Haunted Road Media comes an exciting new novel by author Marla Brooks, Soul Connection, A Deadly Obsession. Two lost souls, ripped apart by murder in another century, find each other again in the present, only to discover that the murderer has followed them through time. Can their love save them, or will history repeat itself? Find out in this captivating new novel by Marla Brooks, Soul Connection, A Deadly Obsession. Available now on Amazon.com and at BarnesandNoble.com.
You've no doubt heard of Tango and Cash, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Perhaps it takes two to tango. Well, now, on the first and third Thursdays of each month, there's a show called Tango and Friends at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network with your host, Bruce Tango. And yes, there will be at least two to tango on each episode, sometimes even more. There's going to be lots of topics and lots of guests you'll all know and lots of surprises. Tango and Friends, every first and third Thursday of the month at 8 p.m. right here on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening into Stirring the Cauldron. I just wanted to give you a quick heads up, if you don't already know, about the free weekly Witches Oracle Deck readings that I post on my website every Monday. Now, let me answer the age-old question before you ask it, which is, well, how do I know it's for me? And the answer is pretty simple. If you weren't meant to see it, you wouldn't know it was there. So if you're curious about what the week has in store for you, pop on over to marlabrooks.com every Monday and scroll down on the homepage, and there it will be.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Yes, we are back, and my guest tonight is author Scotty Roberts, and we're talking about his book, The Secret History of the Reptilians. Scotty, I've got a couple of chat room questions that we've got to get in. We really need like 3 hours for this show, so we're going to have to... Tabby wants to know, she said, if those aliens that are considered reptilian, is it possible that those that have remained on Earth are living underground and only coming out when the climate allows it?
You know, that's possible, but here again, I'm going to give my pet answer, which is not a satisfactory answer for anybody, not even for me. I just have to say it this way. I say, but we don't know for sure. There's nothing that we know about this. You can know something, quote unquote. Let's say if you're a psychic medium or a clairvoyant or something, there is a way, a certain way of knowing things. And I don't cast doubt on that. I just say it's not going to stand up to scientific scrutiny. Same thing with if we talk about reptilians that come out from the underground, the subterranean. That is a great theory, and it might be true, but we don't know because there's who's been there and been back. Who has recorded that? Perhaps a remote viewer, perhaps a psychic, perhaps somebody like that. But where do you get your substantive information from to be able to draw a substantive conclusion? That's the problem. Even from a guy who's a firm believer in this stuff, I have to throw doubt at it because I can't qualify it. I can't quantify it. So I hope that answer helps. We don't know.
All right. Ceiling Cat has an interesting question. How does the alien reptiles fit into Eastern philosophy and religion then?
Oh, the alien reptiles. Well, I don't know precisely how they fit into philosophy, but I do know they appear in almost every ancient culture. Take a very obvious one, China. What did you have in China? You had the Chinese dragon, which is a symbol of happiness, of fertility, of purity, and things like that. It was actually a good serpent to have around. But this was part of the Chinese culture, their religious, if you will, their spiritual culture. You have in India, when you had Krishna, who was seen sitting atop a coiled serpent beneath the banyan tree, delivering the forbidden knowledge of the gods. The serpent has become part, it's almost like he's a prop in the story, but he's sitting atop the coiled serpent. And he's delivering this information. And for this, what happens? He ends up being executed for delivering the knowledge. You've got the story of the serpent in the garden. You've got the story of, even in the Irish tales, the Tuatha De Danann. They were the ones that were supposed to be the great kings who came from heaven. The tall, bright, blonde-haired, bright-skinned creatures who were the kings from heavens. And they were subjugated and driven into what came to be known as the Hollow Hills and in those battles. And that's related to the same reptilian stories. So all of his question is, how does it relate to these religions or these spiritualities or these cultures? Well, it kind of does and it kind of doesn't. All the serpent is, and I could name off more and more and more and more cultures that have all of these in their spiritual stories. But the serpent seems to be this, it's like the subtitle of the book, the pervasive presence of the serpent in human history, religion, and alien mythos. It's a perpetual presence, yet there is no definitive proof of its presence. It's just there. It's mentioned. It has different qualities about it. in these different cultures. Everybody adapted something about the serpent, it seems, into their culture, and they made it work for them. So is that a question of a real thing that is at the headwaters of that? Or is this something I learned in Star Trek as a kid and didn't realize I was learning this? They talked about the common evolution of different races and peoples across the galaxies. And this is what we say, is that maybe people evolved, maybe people evolved in the same way across every culture, and they adapted the same stories. That's like the flood story. We all know there was a flood, maybe two of them, great universal floods on this planet dating to like 6,000 BCE and 8,000 BCE. But every culture seems to have their version of that story. And, little things going on around me here. So every culture has those things that they've adapted to their own culture, their own spirituality. There's over 600 different ancient cultures that speak of a flood story. And I'm talking cultures ranging from major cultures to tribal cultures that talk about these things. So that same thing. I hope that's a satisfactory answer.
You know, the book is so thought-provoking that in my mind, it was all over the place. I'm going to want to talk about serpent and alien subculture in a minute. But the thing, I started to laugh because there was so much to ponder. Strange thoughts popped into my head. Like, did God create all the creatures on Earth, like reptiles and snakes and lizards? Or did those ancient aliens, reptilians, bring along their little pets and integrate them into our world for some reason to spy on us or something? You know, I mean...
Well, it's a great question.
This is a kind of...
It's a great question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say...
Your
turn. I'm shutting up.
No, you dance first.
No.
One thing we know for sure is that almost every creature we know of on this planet has parts of the same DNA. And the only thing they found that was an oddity was in the 1950s, when they found that there was this, I'm doing this off the top of my head, I don't have it in writing in front of me, but the I was with the rhesus monkey, and it was with, they found that some humans had a strain of DNA that they described back then, not being in league with anybody that was giving a fanciful story of creation or reptilians, but they said, there's nothing else like this on Earth. And some humans have this rare strain of DNA. And so you can ask that question. Did all life that exists here, did it all come from one place? Did it come from other places? What is this rare strain of DNA that, you know, DNA research was in its infancy in the mid-20th century. So what did they discover about that? They discovered that something unlike anything else on the planet exists in this certain strain of humans. So
all right,
where'd it come from?
So here was the follow-up question to that. Yeah, was that, it's very popular concept these days that reptilian humanoids have been talked about, you know, many times over the years, going back to the Nephilim, who are thought to have extraterrestrial origins, or maybe even further. Do you believe that the bloodline of humanity could possibly have been interfered with by extraterrestrials?
Well, yes. I think that's possible. You have to go to science, and you have to ask that question. It's like, you look at you've seen the Hubble infrared photography that was done several years ago now, where they took something that if you held your hand up and looked at the night sky, your pinky fingernail would take cover the area of space that they photographed. Mm-hmm. And when they photographed this area of space, what did they find? Over 10 days, they did an infrared picture. In that little tiny slice of sky, they found over 10,000 galaxies. And so they did the quantum math and said, if you spread this over the whole night sky, you've got millions upon millions of galaxies that contain millions upon millions of solar systems. And so they were using this to say that the likelihood of there being life out there from somewhere else is probably very high. And so you look at an experiment like that, just in photography, and if you extrapolate that information back and say, is it likely that something else may have visited here at one time in the past? Science will tell you, well, no, we don't have any ability to travel fast. We know how it takes to travel at the speed of light, and it's impossible. Well, now they're starting to find, even this last couple of weeks, with the Hadron stuff in Switzerland, or Sweden, Switzerland, that they're finding that there are particles that travel faster than the speed of light. So just because we don't know it scientifically yet in our understanding doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But everything after that is speculation, because we don't know what else exists beyond that point. So I think that big, long, drawn-out, as I'm wont to do, answer to your very simple question, yeah, I think things could have come from some other place and been here. Richard Feynstein, the quantum physicist in the 1960s and so on. He was contemporary of Einstein, of Oppenheimer. He used to give a lot of lectures, and he'd say, in his accent, he goes, the earth, to think that some manifestation of God came to the earth. He says, I find that too provincial, too colloquial, to fit into my understanding of the vastness of the universe. But at the same time, he says, for me to doubt something like that is the way I operate. He says, I would rather die not knowing the answers to certain questions than to die having believed a lie my whole life. And he was talking about religion. He was talking about it. And so what we have to do by expanding our minds and expanding our understandings of things, this is what helps us understand what we're supposed to understand, how we should be thinking, to understand things beyond the scope of our thinking. So all of that, I'm laying down philosophy to give the simple answer of, well, first of all, I don't know for sure. Second of all, I think it's possible. I don't know why it wouldn't be possible with the vastness of the universe. To quote Carl Sagan's book and Jodie Foster in the movie version of Contact, she and her dad were talking, and she said, wow, that's an awful lot of space out there. It would be an awful lot of waste of space if there's nobody else out there. So I think they're there. Have they visited here? We've got lots of stories. What's the word? It's not coming to my head. There's a definition of a word that means we have placed religious or spiritual or some kind of mythological story on top of something to be able to explain it to the common mind. It would be like taking the Garden of Eden story. Say, this is how man began. I can't think of what the word is now, but you know what I mean. Create stories. I create stories for my children. I tell my children stories at bedtime. I read books to them. I tell them stories. I sing them songs. And all of these things are usually comprised of stories that we create from, we may not think about it this way, but they all come from that mythological past where we're trying to explain something in a certain way. We're trying to explain love. We're trying to explain the heroic. We're trying to explain aliens, which my kids are deathly afraid of, but they've never seen one yet.
Right.
Why can't you go upstairs and use the upstairs bathroom? Oh, there's aliens. God, I'll walk with you up there. So, simple answer is yes. I believe there's something else that was here, and I believe our cultural and mythological tales demonstrate that.
And, you know, one of the things, and we're, as we're talking and you're saying you don't know and we're doing theory and stuff, you do have your personal opinions on the subject in general, but while you come up with concepts, you put information out in the book, both religious and secular, and manage to try not Well, you don't try to influence the reader in any way, and you allow them to make up their own minds. And as with me, all these questions and these weird things kept popping into my head. And to me, that makes a really good book. If it makes me think, it's a very good book. Well, so you did it in a really good way.
Thanks. I like to be able to present information that has a lot of questions around it. Mm-hmm. In a way that says, look, you can make up your mind. You just have to know what tools to use to get to your conclusions. Mm-hmm. And I have my pet theories. I have my belief system. Mm-hmm. I have my beliefs that certain things are certain ways. Mm-hmm. Can I prove most of those? Hell no, because it lies in a different realm of explanation. Everything, it seems religiously, you've got to believe something by faith in order to give it solidity. I have lots of debates with people that want to debate me about religious stuff and so on. And like one I hear that is a pet peeve of mine is somebody said, well, the whole Bible, you can't trust the Bible. It's just a book of fantasy and myths. And I said, well, wrong. I said, there's a hell of a lot of stuff in the Bible that's been verified by science, by archaeology, by history. Mm-hmm. I said, now the faith element in the Bible, you might be right. It's one religion's book of faith, mm-hmm. a collection of books of faith. And I said, they believe those things by faith. The converse is when I have a discussion with somebody from within the faith. And I said, well, how do you know that that's... I was sitting across the table from a paleontologist. We were doing some filming, and he was a Christian man who was a paleontologist. And he said, well, the earth's only 6,000 to 7,000 years old. And he was giving all his reasons for it. And I said, that's an interesting theory, Joe. I said, well, how do you arrive at that theory? Well, the Bible says that, and he kept giving me answers like that. And I said, look, I'm not against the Bible. I've studied it for years. I appropriated that. I was a man of faith at one time. And I said, you're using an argument from within the argument. You can't say, I believe this faith to be true because the faith tells me it's true. I said, mm-hmm. step outside that box for a minute and look back in and give me your answer. And he couldn't do it. He didn't have the tool. He didn't even understand what I meant. Damn. And this is all I ask people to do, even on reptilians, on the Nephilim, on Moses, or religious things. Mm-hmm. Step outside the box of faith and look back in and mm-hmm. see what makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
All right. You know what? Next time I invite you on my show, remind me we need 2 hours, okay? Please.
Okay.
And we can.
I have to. Yeah. I have my own radio show to do in about 5 minutes. So.
I know. So that's what I wanted to do. I just want you to tell everybody where they can find you, websites
Certainly. Or
whatever, and then talk a little bit about the radio show, and then get the hell out of here. So you won't be late for your show. Yeah.
There you go. You can find me over on probably the best place is my website. It's my full name, ScottAllenRoberts.com. Scott's with two T's, and I got to spell Allen because there's like five ways to spell it. So mm-hmm. A-L-A-N, one A at the beginning, and one L, one A, one N. So ScottAllenRoberts.com. And up in that header and in my links on there, you're going to find links to everything I do, my radio show, my books down at the bottom of every page. You're going to find my Facebook. You're going to find my phone numbers on there. I've had that same phone number since God knows when. And so you can call me if you have a question.
Yeah,
the aliens can't get them. Yeah. I had some guy call me one time on my phone, and he said he didn't identify himself. He says, Scotty, a voice like that. And I was having a dinner party in my house. Yes? He goes, the forces of darkness and the forces of light are fighting over you in heaven tonight, and the wings of the black raven are fluttering. And it was poetic, and I'm like, God? No, I said, who is this? And he says, who I am doesn't matter.
Uh-oh.
And that's all. And then he hung up. And I'm like,
I would have changed
okay.
my phone number right then. Yeah.
I still have the same phone number.
All right, so tell really quickly about your show that you're going to do right now in a minute. So talk about it.
Sure. My show, the Intrepid Radio Program, it's on the Odyssey Radio Network, but we're not broadcasting on there right now because I'm kind of in a makeshifty situation living away from my home for a couple of months doing some work out of state. And so it's over on my YouTube. My YouTube is Mr. Scotty Roberts, Mr. all spelled out.
There you go.
And
well,
that's where you find me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please come back shorter than, you know, 10 years from now. Because then we'll both okay. be bald. We won't have gray hair. We'll be bald.
Yeah, all really. Right. I'll be polishing my head instead of cutting my hair.
There you go. So, all right. Well, thank you. Thank everybody for listening in tonight. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Circle be open, but unbroken. May the peace of the goddess be ever in your heart. Merry meet and merry part, and merry meet again. Merry meet again. Merry meet again.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.